Hello and welcome to this Challenge Poverty Week Fraser Vallander podcast special. So, as I just said, it is Challenge Poverty Week this week, which is an annual event in Scotland where lots of organisations and people come together to talk about how we can tackle poverty. Today, I'm joined by Peter Kelly from the Poverty Alliance and Chris Burke from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation in Scotland. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on this week, some of the big reports that are part of this week's timetable, and also thinking ahead to the next few months and years in terms of what needs to be done to tackle poverty in Scotland. So Peter, why don't you tell us a bit about Challenge Poverty Week and what it's all about?
Sure, thanks Emma. So I guess a good place to start is why we initiated Challenge Poverty Week in the first place. So it was back in 2013. So if listeners are to cast their minds back, they'll remember maybe that the Welfare Reform Act was passed in 2012. And with the Welfare Reform Act came not just the decision to introduce universal credit, but also the bedroom tax, also personal independence payment, the benefit cap was introduced. So it was quite a, shall we say, febrile time in social security policy. There was a lot going on. But at the same time as all that change happening, the narrative around social security, around welfare, and around people who use the social security system was really quite negative. If you remember at the time, there was a lot of discussion about, to use the polite term, welfare dependency, but really how that came out, particularly in the popular press at the behest, I would say, of the UK government at the time, was a lot of language around strivers and skivers and shirkers of various descriptions. So we wanted to run Challenge Poverty Week to act as a kind of counterweight, if you like, to some of those more stigmatizing narratives. We wanted to show that there was a different way of thinking about poverty. There was different things that we could do around poverty that weren't just about belittling people who were living on low incomes and trying to drive them into low-paid and unstable jobs. We wanted to encourage a more, I guess, more positive and, I guess, more accurately, a more useful discussion about what we can do about poverty, and also particularly about what was already being done in communities to address poverty. That the idea that people who were living in poverty and communities that were affected by poverty weren't somehow without agency, that community organisations and local and national governments were taking action all the time to address poverty, and we needed to have that reinforced. But I guess the overriding emphasis in Challenge Poverty Week was to try and galvanise support amongst a really broad cross-section of civil society for alternatives to the kind of policies that we were seeing coming out, particularly again from the UK government at that time, particularly around the whole welfare reform agenda. And Challenge Poverty Week was intended to be a space to be able to do that, and to do it in a concerted and consistent fashion. So when we started off in 2013, it was a relatively small number of organisations, I would say, were involved in the first year. Maybe 20 or 30 organisations managed to do something every day of the week, and it has grown significantly since then, in no small part due to the funding support from Joseph Rowntree Foundation for the last few years. It's allowed us to really build on some of the early lessons, and particularly to build on how we change the narrative about poverty. That's a really important part of Challenge Poverty Week, is that we change the way that we talk about poverty. And I think the work that GRF have done around how we frame poverty has been really important for the way that Challenge Poverty Week has developed. So it's not just an awareness raising week, it's actually about all the the work that goes on to train people, to support people, and particularly to support people who are living on low incomes to talk about poverty and to speak out about poverty. So those broad approaches that I mentioned in terms of the impetus behind Challenge Poverty Week hasn't really changed. Our key messages are broadly the same, that too many people are locked in poverty in Scotland, and that we need to redesign our economy to better reflect the shared values we have around justice and compassion. And throughout the week, last year we had our first online, fully digital Challenge Poverty Week. This year it'll be a bit of a mix. I attended my first in-person event in the last 18 months this morning, which was interesting. And right across the country, there'll be hundreds of events taking place. A lot of them will be online again. Some of them will be in person. And it's really down to organisations themselves to prioritise what it is that they want to do. We have themes running throughout the week around social security, around employment, green economy and so on. But it's really down to groups themselves to identify what it is that's important to them in tackling poverty.
Do you think it's kind of the profile of it kind of cuts through, I suppose? Like, has that been successful over the year? Because it is something that any stakeholders who work in poverty know about Challenge Poverty Week, but how well do you think it cuts through to kind of general public or to politicians and that kind of thing?
I think that's a good question. I think it's still taking its time to cut through. I think this year, I guess there is a, not quite an elephant, but there is one issue that's dominating discussions around poverty and inequality this year, and that's the cut to universal credit that's coming up this week. But I think we have managed to cut through. For this week, we're able to probably to reach a bigger audience through some of the things that we normally do. And I think one of the important parts of Challenge Poverty Week now is trying to bring different voices into some of the discussions. So we've been more successful in bringing in health voices that might not have been so central, or some new business voices into some of the discussions about tackling poverty. And we've got school children and schools taking action to talk and think about poverty. So these things are all really important. But fundamentally, we're galvanising civil society, I think, in a way that we weren't as anti-poverty campaigners really doing in the past. So I think it's helping with that, there's no doubt. But, you know, as I said, universal credit cut and the potential that that has to set us off course in terms of our priorities for tackling poverty in Scotland can't be underestimated. And that's why GRF's report that was published this morning, I don't know if Chris maybe wants to come and say a bit about that, published this morning, has been so important and really sets out the big challenges that we face to address poverty in Scotland now.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, I mean, we were delighted to have one of the first events, I think, of Challenge Poverty Week. We had a hybrid launch with the Cabinet Secretary, Shona Robson, in Dundee this morning. And yeah, I mean, our report this year is kind of stolen some of the patter of the UN Secretary General about climate change, about kind of having a code red warning about the impending child poverty targets, because in our view, and I think this is pretty widely held, to be honest, if the Scottish Government don't do more, we're going to miss the interim child poverty target. So our report sets out updates on modelling that we did prior to the election, but really just on whether or not we're going to meet the targets. And then also looks at, as Peter said, we're really keen, excuse me, to bring out the voice of people on low incomes. And so actually, I think one of the best chapters of the report is really reflecting on the challenges and the barriers that they face and their kind of daily struggles to help improve the lives of their families. And it's stuff that we've all been saying for a long time, and barriers such as childcare and transport and just the stigma that people face, and some of the skivers, etc. stuff which Peter's talked about. But then really importantly, we've gone into quite a lot of depth on the priority groups, which the Scottish Government identified in the last Tackling Child Poverty Delivery Plan, the six different families there, and really looked at what progress there has been, or not been, as the case mainly is, against those groups. So, unfortunately, and I know you've spoken about this many times, Emma, for quite a lot of these groups, there isn't a lot of data out there. So we're relying on pretty patchy intelligence, but we're able to break down in a bit more detail what experiences of families who, families like single parent families, families where somebody's disabled, or larger families, and the different pressures that they come under. And that kind of led us as well to the concentration of worklessness in some of these households, and nobody in a household being able to secure work. So for single parents, you know, it was over 6 in 10 of the families the parent wasn't able to get into work. So therefore relying on the very inadequate social security system, and very likely then living in poverty. So yeah, I mean, there's lots in it. I would encourage folks to read it from cover to cover, obviously. But I think it's laying down a challenge to the Scottish Government. There's a lot more to do to meet these targets. And I know that is, you know, we've done some modelling before the election, but I know that you're working on a more kind of detailed piece to look at both how we get toward the interim targets, but then onwards to the 2030-31 ones.
Yeah, it's something that we've seen over the past, well, since the Child Poverty Plan was introduced, there's a relatively good understanding of, you know, what the problem is, although with data lacking for some groups to actually, you know, really understand what those barriers are. But yeah, there's a relatively good understanding of what the issue is and where it's concentrated. And in some ways, you know, there's a sort of a tacit understanding of what needs to be done. But what there hasn't been since the child poverty targets were put into statute is a kind of a measurable plan of action in terms of how the targets are going to be met. I mean, I remember when the bill was passed, there was talk about, you know, shouldn't that be almost on the face of the bill in terms of actually, you know, setting these targets, well, what are you actually going to do? But the way it's been set out, there are these delivery plans that every 4 years or so that set out, you know, what's going to happen in order to try and meet the targets. And we've got one coming up in March next year for, you know, which will take us past the interim targets and into close to the final ones. So it's something we've been thinking about quite closely as, you know, people who spend our life doing economic modelling. So, you know, what are the policies that could be put in place, and how far can they get us towards the targets? And, you know, what is the gap that potentially needs to be filled with social security? But, you know, it's not just about trying to get the figures to add up. It's trying to understand what the choices are as well, because, you know, there are different ways in order to, you know, meet these targets. There's always a question around things like universal v means tested benefits and, you know, the impact it has on people trying to claim them. There's always, you know, that debate about, you know, promoting work versus, you know, just getting money in people's pockets so that they can actually make their own choices and make their own way and, you know, and retrain and find work over a slightly longer term. So there are all these areas and choices, as I say, in terms of policymakers. And there are lots of wider impacts of this, of these type of policies. I mean, to meet the targets, it's transformational in terms of what it will mean for household income. And that will have an impact on the wider economy. A very, you know, positive one from one perspective, in terms of, you know, that money will be consumed and, you know, that will have an impact, you know, positive impact on the economy, but it also has to be, you know, funded. And that's either through reallocating money within budgets or it's from raising taxes. And that itself has its implications. So there's a lot to unpack and understand. We, you know, we're doing this as to kind of try and, you know, help things along a bit, but these are things that the government really should be, you know, at the forefront of trying to get their heads around, and we, you know, we'll see in due course to what extent that will be. But I mean, I was just interested in both of you, your views into, you know, what are the implications if we do miss the interim targets? Because they're about 2 years away now, haven't got long in order to get policy in place to really make an impact. Although there are things that can be done, particularly through social security system and those timescales to get there. But the interim targets, you know, they're halfway towards the final targets. But yes, your report this morning, Chris, laid out, we're at a big risk of missing them completely. And I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of what that will mean for, you know, obviously people in poverty. It's, you know, it's a terribly, terrible missed opportunity. But in terms of the actual kind of momentum and belief that meeting these targets is possible, I mean, how detrimental do you think it could be?
Well, I mean, firstly, I mean, we've not missed them yet. And as you've said, there are definitely ways in which the Scottish Government could act to meet them. Both we and Fraser-Valander before the election put together scenarios where you could meet the interim targets just through Social Security. So ultimately, I mean, the Scottish Government are legally obliged to meet them. This isn't just, you know, it's not just a post-it note on the to-do list. You know, this is a legal obligation. And there are also things like the UNCRC is about to come into force, subject to whatever the Supreme Court say about it. But so there are poverty levels that I think we just have to accept are unacceptable. But I think what the pandemic has also shown a harsh light on is that there is a real depth of destitution in Scotland and across the UK at the moment, which really does provide immediate challenges to the Scottish Government and local government and third sector organisations all over the country. So, you know, I think if the Scottish Government were sort of saying, look, we really need to get on and fix these things first to give us that platform to build towards the 2030-31 targets, you kind of be saying fair enough. Because let's face it, that, you know, 18% child poverty is far too high anyway. You know, really those 2030-31 targets, as you say, a very different Scotland to the Scotland we would see today. That's the goal. So really what all these interim targets are about is, as you say, keeping momentum, keeping us going there and hopefully building a platform towards those final ones. But I don't think the current Scottish Government would be comfortable at all if these targets were missed. I mean, I think they would face, rightly, criticism from across the political spectrum. These are their own targets. And yes, the UK government certainly don't help them. And of course, the pandemic hasn't helped. But people keep talking about, well, we can't go back. You know, things before the pandemic were unacceptable. And so we can't go back to that. Well, you know, let's live up to that rhetoric. So, you know, I know certainly I wouldn't lose the momentum if it looked like we were going to miss them. But as you say, we just can't take our foot off the pedal.
Yeah. And I mean, your report makes clear it's, you know, we know it's coming. We know we're a couple of years away from them. And we know that there is policy that could be deployed to meet them. So it's almost, you know, obviously there's a lot going on behind the scenes in terms of, you know, budgets and all sorts to get that money in place, but it can be done and there isn't really an excuse for it.
I think ultimately it's if the Scottish Government have a way of doing it other than Social Security, it's kind of on them to tell us what it is.
Peter, what are your thoughts?
I agree with Chris. I think the thing that we need to keep reinforcing that this is legally obliged. So one of the flaws, I think, in the Labour, UK government Labour's approach in the early 2000s when they set child poverty targets and eradicating child poverty and so on, was that they were never in law. They were things that they weren't in law until 2010. So there were things that could be more casually dropped from policy commitments, and that's more or less what happened. With that option doesn't exist in Scotland. They Scottish Government will be held to account by the Parliament, will be held to account by civil society, and therefore there's a role for all of us to make sure that these targets don't just roll past and that we shrug our shoulders and say, well, it's been a really difficult time, hasn't it? That we bring to the fore the stories that Chris was talking about and the real lives that that are affected by poverty, and that we keep that to the forefront of the discussion. And I think there's a genuine cross-party commitment to see these targets reached, not just the interim ones, but the ultimate 2030 ones. But there isn't yet, I think, the consensus around the means with which you'll do that. And I think that's what we need to see more of. There's an agreement around doubling the Scottish Child Payment, for example, but there is still clearly disagreement over the timescale for that. And even with the doubling, what else will still need to happen? So, but as you say, Emma, the policies are there. We have many of the tools. We don't maybe have them all, but we have many of the tools. And there are other actors that need to be brought into this perhaps more clearly to say how we're going to build a sustainable route out of poverty, and that's about bringing employers more centrally into some of these discussions, and to have perhaps a tougher conversation with some employers, but also a more encouraging discussion with some others who want to do the right thing and are heading in that direction, but we maybe need to find ways to pick up the pace and improving our labour market alongside improving our social security system.
Yeah, I mean, it's the spotlight will be on the Scottish Government, quite rightly so, for the next 6 months, I think, with child poverty in particular, because of the delivery plan and because of things like, you know, setting out the timescales for the doubling of the Scottish Child Payment. Although Ms. Robson this morning, I think, said with you, Chris, that will be announced at budget. So that's a good sign. So hopefully it'll be fairly imminent in that case. And then, yes, I say the next challenge, child poverty delivery plan in March. But beyond that, and thinking ahead to the child poverty targets, yeah, it's, as you say, it's not just the Scottish Government, and there does need to be quite transformational change in order to meet them. So we think about some of the role of other parts of the economy, so employers being a big one. So Peter and I are involved in a new project starting in January, funded by the Robertson Trust, to look at some of the implications for hospitality businesses and the conditions and the ability for people who work in those areas to sustain a good quality job over time. And it's something that's talked about, but maybe not understood as much as it could be, in terms of what are the reasons why employers in sectors like that struggle to retain their staff. You know, it's clearly good business to keep staff and keep them happy and keep them productive. It's not always about pay either. It's often about the conditions that allow people to, you know, deal with life as well as a job at the same time. So I think there is a lot of work that we hope to do, and I hope others as well, in order to look at all aspects of the Scottish economy, not just public policy, in order to think about how you build that constructive path towards the targets that should be a win-win situation. But it's in theory it sounds very simple. In practice, you know, we're really going to try and get into it and really work with businesses to understand what's going on for them. And no doubt that's much more difficult coming out of the pandemic than it was, you know, 2 years ago. I was wondering, Chris, what are other things has JRF got up your sleeve, I suppose? you know, what are the big priorities that you see? After the child poverty delivery plan, what's kind of the longer term aims that you think we need to focus on in Scotland?
I'm really interested in some of the point you're talking about, is what does that Scotland in 2030 look like? Because I think as you've said, is yes, there's clearly public policy that needs to be involved and changes need to happen there. How we build the housing system, how we build the transport system, how childcare works and all of that kind of thing. But let's face it, most people are going to be employed if they're working within the private sector in some way. And at the moment, you know, there are far more decisions taken about people's paying conditions taken in boardrooms than there are in parliaments. So those decisions are absolutely crucial to meeting those targets. So I think as well, though, we need to think about if we're heading towards 2030, that's supposed to be a year when our carbon emissions have dropped dramatically over that period as well. So you're seeing a massive overall change in our economy. You know, if we meet our climate change targets and our poverty targets, Scotland will be a very good place to live in 2030, 31. It really would. And I think that's what we all need to keep in mind. So it's, for me, it's all about the transition of how we get there. So how do we build the foundations? Where are we building houses? Who are they for? How are we connecting communities together so as to minimize the emissions from travel, but also enable people living in those communities to access work where they can? How are we transforming how we see unpaid care? Now, what we call unpaid care now, I would hope by 2030 that it would sound ridiculous for somebody like me to talk about unpaid care. You know, the wokies of 2030 would be pulling us up for talking about that kind of thing. Because I do think, you know, we should really see that as a thing of the past. So I'm really interested in kind of looking at that bigger picture. What does that 2030 look at? But there is also a job in hand to unpick some of the immediate challenges. So for example, we're going to do a bit of work looking at the challenges in the labour market for minority ethnic families in Glasgow. You know, we can really see that actually it's in-work poverty is a real driving issue for those communities, but we don't really have a very good understanding of why that is and the extent to which racism will play a role in that, because it probably will. So yeah, we're going to keep looking at these immediate challenges for families just now, but yeah, I've really got an eye on that bigger picture of what that Scotland in 2030 looks like.
Yeah, that is, it's really interesting to have that view. You know, it's not obviously we've got somewhere where we want to get to, but in order to get there you have to deal with what's in the here and now with those, you know, it's sometimes I do find in Scotland we tend to come up with sort of new shiny things that become, you know, well, this is what needs, you know, if we do this will solve everything, be that, you know, universal basic income, you know, which has its pros and cons, but it's such a, you know, it's something that can't be achieved, you know, within the current devolution settlement. So it's something that, you know, one day might come into being, but actually it's not going to help us solve poverty in the here and now, nor is it probably going to be something which, even if, you know, everything changes constitutionally, probably won't actually, you know, be ready in time for 2030-31. So there's so many things that sometimes distract us, I think, or, you know, distract some people in Scotland from the here and now by trying to talk about, you know, big new concepts which are a long way away from reality. Peter?
I think that the challenge for us, and it's probably good to discuss this during Challenge Poverty, where we are very focused on that big picture, on that, you know, what's the transformational change and what will society look like when we've gone through or are going through that transformational change. It's good to hold on to that, I think. And the trick is to do both, is to be able to say, here's where we want to get to. This is the destination. This is what our society might look like, you know, with child poverty rates of less than 10%, which is still quite a lot, but certainly compared to where we are at now, around 24, 25, 26%, whatever it really sits at the moment. You know, that's a society completely transformed. Now, what would that actually look like and feel like for most people, and for, you know, periods where people were living on a low income, for those to be significantly reduced so that people weren't enduring low income for years and were maybe only, if they were, then for a matter of months. And things like the discussions around the minimum income guarantee, I think, are useful in saying, here's where we want to get to. This is what we might, this is how things might look in the future. But here are some very practical steps that we'll need to take to make that transformational change. And it allows us to focus on those key pillars of our society and our economy that need to change. And we can get down into the more granular level, into more of the detail about what needs to change right here and now with some degree of urgency, but with a view to that long-term change. And I think that's really important. Speaking as a campaigner, we need to have both. We need to be able to say, here's practically how we'll do it. This is why it's reasonable and something that's achievable, and this is what it will look like when we finally get there towards something quite radically different than what we have at the moment.
Yeah, it's your optimism meeting my skepticism as an economist. You mentioned minimum income guarantee there, so could you just explain briefly what that is? And because I think there's some confusion sometimes about how that differs from universal basic income as well.
I think the big key difference, and I guess it's a concept still in development as well. It's an idea that needs some fleshing out. But the big key difference, for me anyway, is that it is a minimum income guarantee would be a targeted payment, so not a universal payment. It would be unconditional, largely unconditional. It would be reflective of household and individual circumstances broadly. And I think would be focused on tackling poverty, which I don't know that a universal basic income necessarily would be focused on tackling poverty. So those are, in very broad terms, the sort of the outline of what a minimum income guarantee might look like. There is still a lot of work to be done, I think, in fleshing out that detail and saying, again, how we get there, although I think there are some useful steps, particularly around some of the policy opportunities we have in Scotland at the moment, like the Scottish Child Payment and maybe using more fully some of our other social security powers in Scotland that could start to take us along a journey towards a minimum income guarantee, and also looking at the dimensions around housing, childcare, all those other services that will go to supporting to reduce people's costs and to boosting their incomes.
Chris, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, one of the things which I think your comment, Emma, about we don't need big and shiny necessarily to get to these targets. I mean, I really agree with that. I mean, I think, and like concepts like a minimum income guarantee, and they've sort of taken on the new and shiny, but it's quite an old idea, really. It's that there should be a floor below which nobody's income should go. So the idea of destitution in Scotland or the UK shouldn't even cross anyone's mind. But I think one of the things that's interesting, we had bits of debates within JRF about our position on UBI, as we'd put out blogs in the past which kind of ridiculed it as, or far too expensive, it's silly, don't even think about it. But the reason for me that it comes up regularly in discussions with people who live in poverty is because it's a reliable income and it's easy. You're not getting dragged to the DWP every other week and all of these kind of things. You're not filling in forms all the time. You get the same amount of money as everybody else. You don't, simply by being a citizen of the country. And you can totally see, if you've had to experience accessing support you're eligible for, why that is an attractive prospect. So see one of the not particularly shiny, but could be genuinely transformational things that we need to do in Scotland, and we are a small enough country to do it, is to make our public services and our social security systems far more easy for people to access. Take one random example, the Parental Employability Support Fund. Right? Google that and try and get on it. Almost impossible. This is supposed to be making it easier for parents to get into the labor market. And it's, depending on where you are in the country, it's almost impossible to know, A, what it is, be whether or not you're eligible, how would you apply, et cetera, et cetera. We're just making it so hard. You know, you can say what you want about people like Amazon and how they treat their employees, et cetera. But the reason they've been so successful, it's easy. People use it because it's so easy. It's designed around what the customer wants sitting in their house. Now, they're making billions of pounds off it and firing themselves into space. But we need to take some of that customer-focused approach into our public services, because we are making it so difficult for people to get what they're eligible to that outcomes are worse as a result. If we could improve, if everybody could get everything they're eligible to today, it would feel a lot better for people who are living in poverty. Then we could really work on that, right? How do we boost people's incomes? Is that work? Is that Social Security, et cetera, et cetera? So to me, that's a really simple, but hugely powerful and badly done at the moment concept. You start to see chinks of light in how Social Security Scotland are doing it, but every council, health board, et cetera, needs to think about it and think about it a lot more carefully.
Yeah, well, thanks both. I think that's been a really interesting discussion. So Challenge Poverty Week is all of this week, and you can, I think, find more information. If you Google Challenge Poverty Week, you will find information on that, even if you can't find out about the Parental Employability Scheme. And JRF Report is on their website at jrf.org. That right? Yes. And as always, you can find more information about what we're doing at fraserland.org. So thank you both again for your time today, and I hope you both have a good Challenge Poverty Week.
Thanks, Emma.